Hello, this is Chuck Stevens, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the November 12th, 2025 edition of the New York Times here on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. From the front page, at shutdown nears end, Trump still confronts soaring health costs. The central issue of government closure remains unresolved, leaving Republicans under political pressure ahead of the midterms. The longest government shutdown in U.S. history is coming to an end, but the central issue that caused it, the staggering cost of health care, isn't going away anytime soon. It will continue to bedevil President Trump, especially as the midterm elections draw close. The burden is now on Mr. Trump and the Republicans to bring down costs or risk peril in those elections after a splinter group of Democrats agreed to end shutdown by dropping their party's demand to extend certain health insurance subsidies. Despite repeated promises to offer an alternative to Obamacare, Mr. Trump has nothing much to show on the issue beyond a vague plan to send money directly to policyholders. "We want a health care system where we pay the money to the people instead of the insurance companies," he told reporters in the Oval Office Monday. "We're going to be working on that very hard over the next short period of time." Mr. Trump's statement highlights the pressure on Republicans to articulate their own vision to improve the affordability of health care now that the subsidies that millions of people rely on to pay for coverage are set to expire by the end of the year. Like Mr. Trump, Republicans in Congress who have spent years attacking Obamacare have not offered up any serious alternative since their failed effort to repeal the law in 2017. The White House declined to provide more details of Mr. Trump's latest idea, but the proposal assumes that giving patients a bigger role in purchasing their own care will lead to lower costs and better health outcomes. The evidence that such an approach could significantly lower costs is not strong. Most health spending goes to very sick people who don't have much choice in the care they receive. Research suggests that financial incentives and information about prices can shape behavior for patients seeking elective care, but that kind of spending is a small share of the country's health care bills. Millions of Americans who will lose access to subsidies when the current formula expires are looking at a jump in premiums, in some cases hundreds of dollars a month or more. The Congressional Budget Office estimates that 2 million Americans will lose insurance altogether next year as the prices rise. Mr. Trump seems to be arguing that the subsidy money should not be used to help people buy insurance, but rather be offered to the same people in special accounts. Extending the extra subsidies would be expensive, costing $23 billion next year and nearly $350 billion over the next decade, according to the Budget Office estimate. But even without them, most consumers can still get some help paying their insurance premiums through tax credits established under Obamacare. The Affordable Care Act, which became law in 2010, has been attacked since its inception for failing to constrain health costs, which are higher in the United States than in other rich democracies. But its expansion of health coverage to tens of millions of Americans who would otherwise lack coverage has made the law popular. Democrats expanded funding for people who buy their own insurance during the pandemic, leading to a surge in new insurance signups. It is those added subsidies that are on the line right now. Democrats have embraced health care costs as a central issue this year, mindful of Mr. Trump's first term when he tried and failed to repeal and replace Obamacare. It was an early and messy defeat for him. Republicans in Congress who had rallied around the cause for nearly a decade were unable to agree on a substitute. Democrats ran campaigns focused on the legislative debacle and took back the House the next year. During his campaign last year, Mr. Trump barely talked about health reform. When asked about Obamacare during the presidential debate, he said he would be open to adjusting it if we can come up with a plan that's going to cost our people, our population, less money and be better health care. When pressed on whether he had specific proposals in mind, Mr. Trump said he had a concept of a plan. Democrats forced the government shutdown over health care costs, insisting that Republicans extend extra subsidies that help people pay their insurance premiums, and that Republicans reverse the recent cuts they made to Medicaid. Republicans have said such an extension does not belong on a spending measure, and some have argued that Congress should let the subsidies expire. The handful of Democratic senators who agreed over the weekend to end the shutdown extracted a promise from Republican leadership for at least a symbolic vote on extending the subsidies next month. But the effort has succeeded in thrusting the challenges Americans face in paying for their health care into the political spotlight, at a time when Mr. Trump would prefer to focus on other things. For the most part, Mr. Trump's policy efforts on health care have tended to focus on ancillary issues, such as improving the transparency of health care prices, reducing the supply of illegal fentanyl, and requiring drug companies to offer discounts to patients who buy prescription drugs with their own money. His Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has little to say about how to improve the affordability of insurance coverage, and instead often focuses his attention on topics like vaccines or encouraging a healthier diet. Republicans in Congress have floated some ideas. Their major tax and domestic policy bill cut nearly $1 trillion from Medicaid, about half by scaling back Obamacare's expansion of coverage to the working poor. Some lawmakers continue to talk about Obamacare replacement approaches, though the issue has lost prominence in recent years. This week, Senators Rick Scott of Florida and Bill Cassidy of Louisiana expressed enthusiasm in proposals similar to Mr. Trump's idea. Mr. Trump supported the health care cuts passed this summer, but he frequently downplayed the scale of the changes, inaccurately saying they were narrowly aimed at eliminating fraud. Mr. Trump's newly articulated proposal shares a consumerist bent with those policies. By replacing insurance subsidies with cash payments to individuals, it appears to echo a recent proposal made by Mr. Cassidy, who suggested taking the expiring subsidy money and giving it to consumers in the form of a pre-funded flexible savings account, which can only be used to pay medical bills. But Dr. Cassidy's plan would account for around $350 billion in spending over the next decade, not trillions and trillions of dollars that Mr. Trump has spoken about. In another New York Times news analysis, what if Democrats' big shutdown loss turns out to be a win? Despite considerable hand-wringing in the party about caving to Republicans and the government closure, some Democrats see potential upsides in the outcome. At first blush, the deal that paved the way to end the government shutdown this week looked exactly like the kind of feeble outcome many Democrats have come to expect from their leaders in Washington. After waging a 40-day fight to protect Americans' health, and rather access to health care, one they framed as existential, their side folded after 8 defectors struck a deal that would allow President Trump and Republicans to reopen the government this week without doing anything about health coverage or costs, enraging all corners of the party. But even some of the Democrats most outraged by the outcome are not so certain that their party's aborted fight was all for naught. They assert that in hammering away at the extension of health care subsidies that are slated to expire at the end of next month, they've managed to thrust Mr. Trump and Republicans onto the defensive, elevating a political issue that has long been a major weakness for them. And in holding out for weeks, while Republicans refused to extend the health tax credits, and Mr. Trump went to court to deny low-income Americans SNAP food benefits, Democrats also honored their main message going into 2026, that Republicans who control all of the government have done nothing to address voters' concerns that the cost of living is too high. The end to this government shutdown does not solve their affordability problem, said Amy Walter, the publisher and editor of the nonpartisan Cook Political Report. A deal that included an extension of the subsidies would actually have helped. That vulnerability is clear in the actions of Republicans from states like New Jersey and Virginia, which elected Democratic governors by large margins in last week's off-year elections. Representatives Jen Kiggins of Virginia and Jeff Van Drew of New Jersey, two Republicans facing competitive races next year, recently sent a letter to Speaker Mike Johnson telling him that once the government was reopened, Republicans needed to immediately turn our focus to the growing crisis of health care affordability and the looming expiration of the Enhanced Affordable Care Act premium tax credits. It may turn out that the long-term outcome of the longest government shutdown in history will be a grand-scale political and policy defeat for Democrats. The head-scratching end to a fight they were not willing to see through to victory deflated the party and deepened long-simmering divisions ahead of next year's critical midterm elections. But in shorter term, there could be benefits. Senate Democrats believe that they held together long enough for Mr. Trump to reveal a new level of callousness in his refusal to fund food stamps for 42 million Americans who rely on the nation's largest anti-hunger program. And they believe all of that helped contribute to a mini blue wave last week, one that could continue if Democrats can keep the right issues at the forefront. We are not always a party that has a great message discipline, and we kept the conversation focused on the most important topic, which is the Republican destruction of people's health care, Senator Chris Murphy, Democrat of Connecticut, said in an interview on Tuesday. If that discipline remains, it helps people understand the chasm right now between Trump and Democrats. Mr. Murphy had been one of the most vocal Senate Democrats, beseeching his colleagues to keep standing up to Mr. Trump and hold the line in the shutdown fight. On Sunday night, when 8 members of the Democratic caucus broke their party's blockade on the spending package, effectively assuring that many in the party regarded as a spectacular cave-in and standoff, Mr. Murphy called it a major mistake. He said that Senate Democrats should have held firm in opposition. On Tuesday, Mr. Murphy said he still feared that any goodwill from voters who had been impressed watching Democrats actually fighting back might dissipate quickly now that they have folded. But Mr. Murphy said he was still optimistic that there had been some gains from the pain. There is still a net good that comes from this, he said, noting that the December vote that Senate Republicans agreed to hold on extending the Obamacare tax credits will give Democrats another opportunity to spotlight their health care message. The silver lining of that agreement is that the issue doesn't disappear, he said. Democrats took a gamble when they decided to use the government funding deadline as leverage to demand an extension of expiring Affordable Care Act tax credits that would stave off premium increases and the loss of coverage for millions of Americans. Forcing the party in power to agree to policy demands in exchange for funding the government is a strategy that typically does not result in a win. Veterans of shutdowns past know this, and never expected Mr. Trump to cave to Democrats' demands. The hostage taker never gets the policy demand they claim the shutdown is about, said Patrick McHenry, a former Republican congressman from North Carolina, who helped steer the House through multiple shutdown battles. Do we even remember what the two shutdowns were about in 2018 and 2019? The answer for most people is barely, and only with the help of Google. In 2018, Democrats buckled quickly without winning legislation they were demanding to grant some undocumented immigrants brought to the United States as children work status and deportation protections. In 2019, Mr. Trump ultimately caved in what was previously the longest government shutdown fight without getting $5.7 billion for a border wall he had insisted upon. The shutdown party never defeats a unified majority party, Mr. McHenry said, and the Republican Party is highly unified under Trump. Mr. Trump may have a unique ability to keep his party together, but he also unites Democrats who might otherwise descend into a full-scale civil war. What motivates the Democratic base more than anything is Donald Trump, Ms. Walters said, and that is likely to be more of a factor in next year's midterm elections than any long-term disappointment in the capitulation of Senate Democrats. He is going to do and say so many things that are going to make the Democratic base angry and frustrated, Ms. Walter added. For now, Senate Democrats are looking towards a health care vote next month that they believe will either result in the extension of the subsidies they have sought, or far more likely with large numbers of Republicans casting a politically unpopular vote against helping Americans afford insurance. And they're turning their attention to winning as many concessions as possible on spending legislation, including undoing some of the deep cuts Mr. Trump has made and putting in place guardrails that limit his power. But Democrats like Mr. Murphy say there's a big difference between silver linings and actual triumphs. If we end up passing a full-year budget or a series of continuing resolutions that involve no protections for democracy or health care, Mr. Murphy said, that's really a bad outcome for the country. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Our next article, the Epstein Files Live Updates. GOP lawmakers release thousands of files. Shortly after Democrats released emails showing that Jeffrey Epstein discussed his relationship with President Trump, Republicans on the Oversight Committee released 20,000 additional documents. Here's the latest. House Republicans on Wednesday released a trove of 23,000 pages of documents from the estate of the disgraced financier Jeffrey Epstein after months of delays. Shortly after Democrats released several emails included in the trove that suggested that President Trump knew more about Mr. Epstein's sex trafficking than he has previously acknowledged. The documents were obtained by the chairman of the House Oversight Committee, Representative James Comer, through a subpoena in August. They were published online about 2 hours after House Democrats released an email from Mr. Epstein in which he wrote that Mr. Trump spent hours at my house with one of Mr. Epstein's victims. It was not immediately clear if the release would include other disclosures. The Times is reviewing the documents and will provide updates, but the emails from Mr. Epstein to friends and associates were laced with unflattering, at times mocking, references to Mr. Trump, including a description of Mr. Trump's financial disclosures by an Epstein associate in 2019 as 100 pages of nonsense. A year before that, Mr. Epstein described Mr. Trump as borderline insane in an email exchange with Lawrence H. Summers, the former Treasury Secretary and Harvard University president. House Republicans are walking a thin and perilous political line in the Epstein case. They're seeking to protect Mr. Trump, Mr. Epstein's close friend, until the two men had a falling out years ago. But they have had their own political flank to cover by appeasing a resistive party base that has demanded complete disclosure of Mr. Epstein's interactions with other powerful men. An issue that has at times transcended loyalty to the president. The release of documents appears to be intended to provide Republicans with a defense against charges that they have not released all of the government files on Mr. Epstein and his longtime associate, Ghislaine Maxwell, and possibly to stave off demands, including from some House Republicans, to force release of the files. Democrats claim that the sheer volume of the release on Wednesday was intended to disorient and to distract attention from their revelations about Mr. Trump's actions during the time he and Mr. Epstein were close. Here's what else to know. Who had the documents? The Oversight Committee in August requested documents from the Epstein's estate as part of its investigation into Mr. Epstein, Ms. Maxwell, and the government's handling of their cases. A de facto advisor, a recurring presence in the messages, is the author Michael Wolff, who acted as an advisor to Mr. Epstein. I believe Trump offers an ideal opportunity, Mr. Wolff wrote to Mr. Epstein in March of 2016, according to the emails, suggesting that becoming an anti-Trump voice gives you a certain political cover, which you decidedly don't have right now. Trump connection. The thousands of documents include numerous references to Mr. Trump, including some in which he and Mr. Epstein discuss their relationship. Others are innocuous. In one exchange, Mr. Epstein has apparently pitched on a transaction related to his Boeing 727 by someone who says they previously worked for Mr. Trump. Congress returns. The Republican-controlled House returned to Washington this week for a vote that would end the government shutdown. But the House has been on a 2-month recess, partly spurred by Speaker Mike Johnson's desire to stave off a bipartisan effort to force the Justice Department and the FBI to release an even more comprehensive set of documents from the investigations into Mr. Epstein and Ms. Maxwell. The House's return and the swearing-in of its newest member, Adelita Guilava, Democrat of Arizona, could soon force a vote on a discharge petition demanding that the Trump administration release its investigative files on Mr. Epstein. After President Trump announced in February 2017 that he would choose R. Alexander Acosta, a former federal attorney, as his labor secretary, Jeffrey Epstein wrote his defense lawyer Roy Black to ask who will represent Acosta at hearings. Acosta was the U.S. attorney in Southern Florida when Epstein agreed to a lenient plea deal in 2008 that allowed him to avoid federal sex trafficking charges. Black replied that Acosta would be by himself with perhaps a Trump administration to assist and accompany him. The Epstein deal was brought up during Acosta's confirmation hearing. Acosta defended it, saying it was offered based on the evidence he had at the time. Acosta was confirmed, but he would resign in 2019 after Epstein was charged in New York. That provoked a new round of questions about Acosta's role in the 2008 deal. One theme that emerges from the emails is how the author, Michael Wolff, acted as an advisor to Jeffrey Epstein, the wealthy financier and convicted sex offender. Wolff advised Epstein to take an anti-Trump position as a way of garnering sympathy amid the allegations against him. "I believe Trump offers an ideal opportunity," Wolff wrote to Epstein in March of 2016, according to the emails. "It's a chance to make the story about something other than you, while at the same time letting you frame your own story. Also, becoming an anti-Trump voice gives you certain political cover, which you decidedly don't have now." And as you might guess, this is an ongoing story with frequent updates. More now from the November 12th edition of the New York Times. In the wake of the Edmund Fitzgerald, you listened to radio this week, you might have heard the song by Gordon Lightfoot. "The Mighty Ship," immortalized in song by Gordon Lightfoot, sank 50 years ago now on Lake Superior. New York Times reporter spent a week on a Great Lakes freighter that survived the storm. On a perfect blue sky day in late July, the SS Wilford Sykes was on northern Lake Michigan approaching the pristine shore of Wisconsin's Door County Peninsula. It gave a horn blast, shimmied through a narrow canal, and soon was gliding placidly past the raised bridges and marinas of Sturgeon Bay. Then suddenly, a faint strain came floating up from a passing pleasure boat, a keening guitar line, a stoic beat, in that rich baritone relating the familiar tale of a mighty ship loaded with iron ore, a captain well-seasoned, the gales of November, and 29 men lost in the ice-water depths of Lake Superior. New England has Moby Dick. The Mississippi has Mark Twain. And the Great Lakes have the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. Or so it can seem to those who grew up on Gordon Lightfoot's 1976 folk rock shanty, a surprise hit that has had a life long after life, not just on the airwaves, but also through bumper stickers, beer labels, Lego kits, and memes. Many who hear the song, with its opening invocation of Chippewa legend, assume it's about a 19th century shipwreck, or perhaps rather a fictional one. But it was a real disaster and one much closer to our own time. It happened on the evening of November 10, 1975, when the Fitzgerald, one of the biggest and most modern freighters on the lakes, lost contact during a sudden ferocious storm and then vanished beneath the waves. Today, the Fitz, as many call it, is a touchstone of regional identity and tourism around the Great Lakes, where the 50th anniversary of the wreck will be commemorated in multiple locations. It's a kind of a Midwest Titanic, the largest of more than 6,000 ships swallowed up by the lakes over the centuries. But it's also a disaster with no survivors, and no obvious iceberg, which has inspired the long string of books, articles, documents, and online debates about exactly why and how the celebrated steamer sank. I was on the Sykes with John U. Bacon, the author of the newest entry, The Gales of November, The Untold Story of the Edmund Fitzgerald. The book, drawn from extensive interviews and archival research, considers various theories, but Bacon deliberately avoids what he calls a whodunit approach. Yes, I wanted to find out what happened, but I wanted to find out about the 29 people on the boat, he said. Who were they? What were their lives like? I wanted to return them to their full-fledged humanity, instead of just being victims. For Bacon, a veteran journalist from Ann Arbor, Michigan, the untold story is also the beauty, danger, and sheer scale of the lakes. Why was I surprised to learn the five Great Lakes are bigger than all New England, plus the state of New York, he said. I grew up on these lakes, and I did not know that. They are massive. In the Fitz's day, there were more than 300 Great Lakes freighters on the water. Today, there are fewer than half that, including the Sykes, which I rode for a week across nearly 1,000 miles in three lakes to see how the reality of Great Lakes shipping intersects with the mythology of its most famous wreck. The Sykes, which turned 75 last year, is one of only a half dozen steam-powered lake freighters remaining. For Fitz fanatics, it's also what Bacon calls a VIP, or rather VIB, a very important boat. It loaded up alongside the Fitz at an iron ore dock outside Duluth, Minnesota, on the unseasonably warm and sunny afternoon of November 9th in 1975, and was hit by the same sudden storm, with winds that whipped as much as 100 miles an hour. And after the Fitz vanished from the radar, the Sykes joined the search effort. Today, the 678-foot Sykes offers one of the closest approximations to the Fitz and, for passengers, a surprisingly comfortable ride. It's a throwback not just in the engine room, but also in the guest quarters, a mid-century modern time capsule from the heyday of the American steel industry, when shipping companies regularly wined and dined executives and their wives. The bulky stereo cabinet in the lounge still holds eight tracks of Guy Lombardo and Mantovani. There's also a buzzer, sadly defunct, for summoning another martini. These days, the boat is dry, and the occasional guests eat well, very well, in the galley with the crew. The current kings of the Great Lakes are the newer 1,000-footers introduced in the 70s and 80s. But the Sykes, with its elegant curves and distinctive front pilot house, is beloved by both boat nerds and the mariners who keep it humming. It's a privilege to sail on a boat like this, said Billy Joffrey, the boatswain or head of the deck crew. You can ride on the footers all day, but there ain't nothing like an old steamer. In the spring and from late fall into early January, the Sykes hauls pelletized iron ore from mines around Lake Superior. Summer is limestone season, which runs between huge quarries in northern Michigan and steel mills along the lower lakes. Bacon and I boarded early on a Monday morning in Burns Harbor, Indiana, near Chicago. The plan was to sail up Lake Michigan and pass through the Straits of Mackinac, loading up at two quarries. Then we would head down Lake Huron, as the Fitz would have, and across Lake Erie to Cleveland. Great Lakes freighters are long and skinny, designed to maximize loads while being able to pass through rivers and locks. As we waited to set off, Bacon stood at one end of the deck and described rather how 30-foot waves would have swept across it during the storm that sunk the Fitz. That all seemed very far away as we steamed up Lake Michigan, nothing but sunshine and calm, cobalt blue water. But an unexpected layover in Sturgeon Bay gave us a chance for an overnight road trip 5 hours north to the western edge of Lake Superior, where the Fitz began its fateful voyage. Duluth, Minnesota, with its sister city of Superior, Wisconsin, is one of the largest inland ports in the world. And at 2,300 miles from the Atlantic via the St. Lawrence Seaway, the farthest accessible to ocean-going vessels. It's also Fitz Country, where you'll find tributes in parks, restaurants, bars, and the local Best Western, where a 10-foot scale model of the boat looms near the swimming pool. At Split Rock Lighthouse, about 50 miles from Duluth, on Superior's northern shore, Hayes Shriven, the site's manager, walked us to the edge of the 130-foot cliffs. Next month, nearly 2,000 people are expected to gather there for the annual commemorative lighting of the beacon. Shriven estimates that 75% of annual visitors to the lighthouse arrive already knowing about the Fitz. About once a week, I'll find someone up here playing the song on their phone, he said. Among locals, however, thoughts about the song vary. A lot of people up here will say they're sick of it, said Tom Burns, a retired bartender, told us during a stop at the town bar in nearby Silver Bay, a regular watering hole for crew members on the Fitz. It was pretty cool for a while, but it's gloomy and doomy, and it just goes on and on and on. Burns was a few months out of high school and working at the bar on November 10, 1975, when someone came in from the driving rain to say the Fitz was in trouble. He compared it to his school principal announcing that President Kennedy had been shot. It was just one of them days that you remember, Burns said. Bacon, whose 13 previous books include one about a 1917 maritime explosion that killed nearly 2,000 people in Halifax, Nova Scotia, spent almost 4 years researching and writing The Gales of November. He tracked down and interviewed more than 100 people, including some family members and others connected with the crew, who had never talked about their experiences with a writer. The book includes a dramatic reconstruction of the storm, based in part on recent high-tech research. One computer model drawing on historic weather data shows how frigid air coming down from Canada collided with a storm system coming from the southwest, creating hurricane-like conditions that turned the water from calm to ferocious in just minutes, as Bacon writes, with waves that may have spiked to more than 50 feet. The wreck prompted multiple investigations and lawsuits, but it was Lightfoot's song, which hit number 2 on the Billboard charts, that drove it deep into cultural memory. Bacon interviewed the journalist who wrote the short Newsweek article that inspired Lightfoot and gave him some of the song's phrases and beats. From the opening invocation of Chippewa and the big lake they call Gitche-Gumee, to the winds that came slashing to the church bell that rang 29 times at Mariners Church in Detroit. Bacon also talked with two musicians who played on the song. The song was recorded in one take, which also happened to be the first time Lightfoot, who passed away in 2023, had ever played it with a band. Bacon was relieved to learn that Lightfoot was a stand-up guy who formed close relationships with family members. When Jimmy Fallon wanted to use the song for a comedy routine, he said no. And when performing the song live, Lightfoot changed some lyrics, like one about the main hatch caving in, that echoed a theory later disproved that the crew had failed to properly clamp it. Gord really wanted the families to have peace, Rick Haynes, the bassist, told Bacon. The shipping company, Ogle Bay Norton, was another story. Initially, Bacon writes, it offered victims' families only their final paycheck plus $750 for personal effects. And when Bacon went searching for the archives of the company, which went bankrupt in 2004, he learned that the boxes relating to the Fitz had gone missing. How is that not fishy, he said. Bacon, for his part, avoids definite conclusions about the wreck. He paraphrased the mother of Bruce Hudson, the 20-year-old deckhand from Cleveland, who, along with the rest of the crew, still rests 530 feet below the surface of the lake. 30 men, 29 men and God, and nobody's talking. After we got back to Sturgeon Bay, the Sykes resumed its journey, steaming toward the northern reaches of Lake Michigan, past forested islands ringed with beaches and known sign of habitation, beyond the occasional lighthouse. There were no icy winds blasting in from Canada, just wildfire smoke, which turned the sun into a reddish orb. At twilight, we passed under the Mackinac Bridge, which connects the upper and lower peninsulas of Michigan, one of the longest suspension bridges in the Western Hemisphere. On the rear top deck, a deckhand played the beat-up boat guitar. In the pilot house, the butthole surface came on the satellite radio. Around 2 a.m., we reached Drummond Island near the Canadian border, where we would pick up half a load of dolomite limestone the next morning. Joffrey and Sean Earhart, the second mate, prepared to drop the anchor. "Get ready for 7 seconds of controlled violence," Joffrey said, passing out earplugs. In the late 1960s, the Fitz was known for its DJ captain, Peter Pulser, who liked to announce baseball scores, play Mozart, and tell stories over the ship's loudspeaker when passing through rivers and locks. Those days are long gone, but in populated areas, boats like the Sykes can still draw a crowd. "This is one of the only jobs where people like to watch you work," Earhart said. "You don't get that at McDonald's." Tom Wyatter, the president of Central Marine Logistics, which operates the Sykes, grew up in Detroit, where he was fascinated by the lore of the sea and not eager for a life of holdups at the family liquor store. After graduating from the Great Lakes Maritime Academy in Traverse City, Michigan, he started on the Sykes as a deckhand. "Today, when I came aboard the boat, the faces are different," Wyatter said, "but the personalities and the sounds and the vibe is the same." Wyatter is a passionate advocate for the old steamers and the history that they represent. In the pilot house, he explained the mixture of old and new navigational tools. Paper charts and the original brass Chadburn, that's the telegraph system, used to send speed instructions back to the engine room, alongside GPS and electronic charting systems. "The Sykes is a floating operating antique," he said, "and it wouldn't be running without the dedication of everyone involved." The Fitz disaster, which ushered in widespread safety reforms, was the last major shipwreck on the lakes. For today's sailors, it stands as a symbol of the inherent dangers of the job. Earhart recalled how at his graduation from the Maritime Academy, the cadets all sang "The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald" at karaoke. But on our trip, a passenger who started singing a line in a jokey voice one afternoon was shushed. Talk turned, and not for the first time, to the blackout, an incident last January on one of the last runs of the season, when the Sykes lost power on Lake Superior, not far from where the Fitz went down. The emergency lights came on, but the boat was left with limited controls and no heat. A cell phone video shows it rocking in big swells, the deck full of snow, as a crew member swore like, well, a sailor. Another ship arrived and lashed itself to the Sykes lengthwise, towing it into a cove for safety. And now, it's just another story. A good sea story is one where everyone survives. But it was terrifying going through it, Mike Helmer, a mate's assistant from Mackinac City, Michigan, said. Today, both shipping and shipwreck tourism are big business on the lakes. After we loaded at Drummond and headed into another quarry, Wyatter pointed out remnants of rusted wrecks poking above shallows in the Detour Passage, one of more than a dozen diving preserves in Michigan waters, encompassing some 2,300 square miles and 200 wrecks. We picked up more stone at Calcite, an open-pit quarry covering more than 8,000 acres near Rogers City, Michigan, so big it's visible from space. And then we were headed, as the song puts it, fully loaded for Cleveland. The Fitz was actually headed to a less rhythm-friendly Detroit. As we headed down Lake Huron, Saturday night steaks as big as your face were grilling on deck. Down in the engine room, where it was hotter than 100 degrees, Hal Oswald, a Navy vet with an exotic New Jersey accent, pointed out a faint breeze coming from one corner. "You have to live like a cat," he said. "You find the warm spots in winter, the cool spots in summer." After sunset, we entered the St. Clair River around 3 a.m., just south of Detroit. We passed the now-closed steel mill at Zug Island, where the Fitz would have unloaded and crew might have stopped at some of the more memorable sailor bars described in Bacon's book. The Honeybee was for country alcoholics, one retired sailor recalled, and the Hinky Dink was for psychotic alcoholics. On Saturday morning, a week after leaving Burns Harbor, we entered Lake Erie and headed to the mouth of the Cuyahoga, where the crew would navigate 13 tricky turns through downtown Cleveland. The captain, Mike Grzek, who started 30 years ago on the Sykes washing dishes, plans to retire next year. During the trip, he had been a man of few words. But after breakfast on our last day, he talked about the merits of various boats he has worked on, the ups and downs of the industry, and his matter-of-fact approach to weathering storms that had left more panic-prone mariners curled up in a ball. "You just deal with it and get through it," Grzak said. He laughed, but, you know, looking back, nothing's ever been that bad. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Next up from the Critic Notebook, Michelle Obama's new book is a historical document dressed up as a coffee table book. The look should be studied by generations to come, and not because of what it reveals about fashion, but politics. Michelle Obama's new book, The Look, is a lot of things. It is an Amazon bestseller. It is a glossy photo book full of fashion. It is the story of the expectations that were heaped upon the first black First Lady. And it is the third installment of a trilogy of books by Mrs. Obama that focuses on self-realization, including her memoir, her advice book on overcoming adversity, and this time, a meditation on the power of clothes. But most of all, it's a historical document, capturing a pivotal moment in the evolution of the role of the First Lady, when clothing became an even bigger part of communication. When, in other words, dress became an officially recognized part of the job. That's a bigger deal than it might appear. Mrs. Obama was, after all, the first First Lady to have a stylist, or valet, as Meredith Coop was called, on the East Wing payroll. One employed to help define the visual strategy of the First Lady for every occasion, from public hula hooping to major moments of pageantry. Before the Obamas entered the White House, First Ladies like Jacqueline Kennedy, Nancy Reagan, and Hillary Clinton may have worked with a designer on their dresses for inaugural balls or state dinners. But the relationship was more grace and favor than structural. It was more about pageantry and propriety than diplomacy. And the First Ladies tended to choose one designer, like Cassini or Oscar de la Renta, and stick with him. After Mrs. Obama, however, Melania Trump and Joe Biden each employed a stylist. Hervé Pierre for Mrs. Trump and Bailey Moon for Dr. Biden, who served as a liaison between fashion brands and the East Wing. They worked with many designers for pretty much every occasion, often with a specific set of political priorities in mind. A new template had been created, and it became the norm. Why that happened is, in large part, the subtext of The Look, which was released by Crown last week, and it is why the book matters. It lays bare, in an unprecedented and easy-to-read way, how a wardrobe was transformed into a vehicle of soft political power. In some ways, it was unavoidable. As the first black First Lady, Mrs. Obama knew that her every move was sure to be scrutinized, including every outfit. She had to represent all sides of a very fractious country, and she had to do it as the first First Lady of the social media age. The ability of the world to see and track her every appearance was far greater than it had ever been, and the ability of the world to comment on her every appearance was also greater. Her image, the pictures making their way around Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, mattered in a way it never had before, and thus the choices involved with creating that image mattered. The stakes had changed when it came to clothes. As Mrs. Obama admits in the book, there had been speculation about the purpose behind many of her fashion choices as First Lady in a number of books, including Everyday Icon by Kate Betz and Michelle Obama, the First Lady of Fashion and Style by Susan Swimmer, not to mention in numerous articles by critics like this writer. But this is the first time she has overtly addressed the subject of her style and credited the team. Ms. Koop, the stylist, the hairdressers Yinay Damtu, Nigeri Radway, and Johnny Wright, the makeup artist Carl Ray, that helped make it all happen. Thus, she writes, the decision to choose Jason Wu, then a young, relatively unknown, Taiwanese-born New York designer, to design her inaugural gown was about demonstrating that I was going to champion people and voices and talents that were too often overlooked. Ones who, she went on, represented the diverse talent of American fashion that I wanted to showcase to the world. Thus, the approximately 100 different looks from Mrs. Obama's time as First Lady, memorialized in The Look, not counting what she wore during the campaigns or after the Obamas left the White House, there's a lot of clothing for one woman to wear or shop for in only 8 years. Especially when the criteria for each look being chosen also included diplomatic outreach, as when Mrs. Obama turned to a designer whose background bridged the United States and one of its allies for a state dinner or visit. All the better to, as she writes, pay respect. See, for example, the dress by Tom Ford, an American designer, working in London, that she wore during her state visit to Britain, or the gown by Versace, the Italian brand she wore for the Italy state dinner. Especially when there were also practical concerns to take into consideration. Not just the mores of different countries, but the fact that Mrs. Obama's clothes couldn't restrict her movement, had to allow her to hug someone if desired, and had to be invulnerable to makeup that might rub off during contact. Though Mrs. Obama writes about all of that in The Look, as well as the often racist criticism she received for wearing sleeveless dresses, one subject she avoids is cost. She does note that she tried to introduce affordable but fashionable brands into my closet, including J. Crew. But there's no avoiding the fact that acquiring this many outfits is an enormous expense, a burden borne by the first family, not the state. One of the ways this cost is managed is for a designer to gift an outfit for a major public event to the country, which means that while the First Lady may wear a gown once or twice, it goes into the National Archive or a presidential library rather than her closet. Still, that doesn't change the takeaway of The Look. Just how much Mrs. Obama adapted her own style to the style she felt the country needed became obvious once she left the White House, with her subsequent book tours and related fashion experiments. A Canadian tuxedo, thigh-high boots, straight from the runway Chanel. And that further underscores the point of this book. For any First Lady, selecting the many garments that will define her tenure is not something that happens by accident, nor should it be. It's work. Next up from the New York Times, something I'm wondering about myself. Who pays when AI is wrong? New court cases seek to define content created by artificial intelligence as defamatory, a novel concept that has captivated some legal experts. The story, sales representatives for Wolf River Electric, a solar contractor in Minnesota, noticed an unusual uptick in canceled contracts late last year. When they pressed the former customers for an explanation, the answers left them floored. The client said they had bailed after learning from Google searches that the company settled a lawsuit with the state attorney general over deceptive sales practices. But the company had never been sued by the government, let alone settled a case involving such claims. Confusion became concern when Wolf River executives checked for themselves. Search results that Gemini, Google's artificial intelligence tech, delivered at the top of the page included the falsehoods. And mentions of a legal settlement populated automatically when they typed Wolf River Electric in the search box. With cancellations piling up and their attempts to use Google's tools to correct the issues proving fruitless, Wolf River executives decided they had no choice but to sue the tech giant for defamation. "We put a lot of time and energy into building up a good name," said Justin Nielsen, who founded Wolf River with three of his best friends in 2014 and helped it grow into the state's largest solar contractor. "When customers see a red flag like that, it's damn near impossible to win them back." Theirs is one of at least six defamation cases filed in the United States in the past 2 years over content produced by AI tools that generate text and images. They argue that the cutting-edge technology not only created and published false, damaging information about individuals or groups, but in many cases, continued putting it out even after the companies that built and profit from the AI models were made aware of the problem. Unlike other libel or slander suits, these cases seek to define content that was not created by human beings as defamatory, a novel concept that has captivated some legal experts. "There's no question that these models can publish damaging assertions," said Eugene Volk, a leading First Amendment scholar at the University of California at Los Angeles. In 2023, he dedicated an entire issue of his publication, Journal of Free Speech Law, to the question of AI defamation. The question, Mr. Volk said, is who is responsible for that? One of the first AI defamation cases was filed in Georgia in 2023. The plaintiff, Mark Walters, a talk radio host and Second Amendment advocate, argued that the ChatGPT chatbot had hurt his reputation when it responded to a query from a journalist about gun rights by falsely stating that Mr. Walters had been accused of embezzlement. A fundamental task in many defamation cases in the United States is proving intent. But since it's impossible to know what's going on inside the algorithms that drive AI, models like ChatGPT, the suit and others like it, tried to pin blame on the company that wrote the code, in this case, OpenAI. Frankenstein can't make a monster that runs around murdering people and then claim he had nothing to do with it, said John Monroe, Mr. Walters' lawyer. Mr. Walters' case was dismissed in May long before getting to trial. Among other reasons, the court noted that the journalist had conceded that he did not trust the claim made by ChatGPT and quickly verified it wasn't true. That question, whether third parties are likely to be convinced that the allegedly defamatory content is true, is crucial in such cases. If the individual who reads a challenge statement does not subjectively believe it to be factual, then the statement is not defamatory, Judge Tracy Kaysen wrote in her ruling. OpenAI did not respond to a request for comment. To date, no AI defamation case in the United States appears to have made it to a jury, but at least one, filed in April against Meta by Robbie Starbuck, a right-wing influencer known for his campaigns against diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, has been settled. Mr. Starbuck claimed that while scrolling on X, he had found an image containing false information about him that had been generated by Llama, one of Meta's AI chatbots. The text in the image stated that Mr. Starbuck was in the U.S. Capitol during the riots on January 6, 2021, and that he has ties to the QAnon conspiracy theory. Mr. Starbuck said he was at home in Tennessee on that date and had nothing to do with QAnon. Meta settled in August without ever formally responding to the complaint. As part of the settlement, the company brought Mr. Starbuck on as an advisor focusing on policing Meta's AI. Since engaging on these important issues with Robbie, Meta has made tremendous strides to improve the accuracy of Meta AI and mitigate ideological and political bias, Meta said in a statement at the time. The company declined to disclose additional terms of the settlement or whether Mr. Starbuck was paid for his advisory work. Last month, Mr. Starbuck also sued Google over its AI in the defamation suit, which seeks $15 million in damages. He claimed that Google's large language models, the technology that helps power the chatbots, had made patently false statements about him. This time, however, he argued that the errors were the deliberate result of political animus baked into its algorithm. Google has not formally responded to the complaint, but Jose Castaneda, a company spokesman, said the majority of Mr. Starbuck's claims dated to 2023 and were addressed at the time. He asked, as everyone knows, if you're creative enough, you can prompt a chatbot to say something misleading. No prompts were required for Dave Fanning, a popular Irish DJ and talk show host, to discover what he said was a defamatory material about him on the internet. The content featured on Microsoft's MSN web portal was an article with his photograph on top and the headline, Prominent Irish Broadcaster Faces Trial Over Alleged Sexual Misconduct. Mr. Fanning, who has not been charged with sexual misconduct, learned about it after people reached out to ask about the allegations. Eventually, he discovered that a news site based in India had used an AI chatbot to produce the article and had added his photo alongside the text. Microsoft then posted the article, which was briefly visible to anyone in Ireland who logged on to MSN or used the Microsoft Edge browser. Early last year, Mr. Fanning sued both Microsoft and the Indian news outlet in Irish court, one of a handful of AI defamation suits that have been filed outside of the United States. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the November 12th issue of the New York Times. Your reader has been Chuck Stevens. Thank you for listening.